There seems to be an urgency about it too. This is what Empedocles says about his own words to whoever will listen to his words. If you don't pay attention to my words, and if you reach out instead after other kinds of things, after all the 10,000 worthless things that exist among humans, blunting their cares, then you can be sure that these words will only too gladly leave you with the circling of time, longing to return to their own dear kind. For you need to know that everything has intelligence and a share of awareness. You see, he's saying that words are alive. And we have become so obsessed with ourselves. It's all about me, 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 and the other person, the other person, the other person, what I'm trying to say, what someone else is trying to say. And what Empedocles is saying is this impossible truth, something else. Words are intelligences in their own right. Sometimes you may catch a glimpse of this. Sometimes you may hear something coming out of your mouth. You have no idea where it's coming from. It's coming from you, but you have no idea what it is. These words are alive. And that actually involves a tremendous responsibility. Because if you start to see that words are alive, they are living beings, every word, then there's a tremendous obligation to start to become conscious of this and to serve these beings and to help them come out into the world in a way that gives them life and that allows those words to give life in this illusory world of other people. And this is from a Hermetic text, a few hundred years after Empedocles, belonging in the same tradition. See how it's the same teaching. Nobody has noticed it. It's so interesting to see how translators just skip over these passages, they translate them grudgingly, as if it means nothing. And here you have the teacher saying, if you fail to take in through your ears with attention and dedication the speaker's words, this teaching will quickly fly away and flow right past you. Or rather, it will actually flow back on itself and return again to join its own source. See, the words know where they come from. Inbuilt in words is this longing to return to their own home. Words automatically, when they're spoken with consciousness, they actually help our longing because they have their own longing to take us back to their conscious home. And what is the opposite of that? That is what happens in this world. Now, I remember years ago I was actually in the underground, in the train system in London. I was on a train, and suddenly I looked up, and it was very strange. I actually saw that the root of all evil is, it's not money, it's not greed, it's not lust for power. The root of all evil is gossip. Because what we do with gossip is we actually abuse something sacred, and then all hell breaks loose. I mean, all of these words the billions and trillions and trillions of words being pumped out every day around the world, they're this totally negative, destructive magic. And behind is this reality of the words as something alive. Now, we can't understand words until we start to understand silence. I think this is the last thing I'll talk about. This is very tricky. See, there's a certain silence in this room, but it's not a real silence yet. And I want to see if between now and when we finish this talk, a real silence can come into the silence in this room. Let me go back to the beginning for a moment. Back to around when the world began. When Pythagoras, who was connected with Empedocles and the other people in this tradition, when he came back from Iran about 2,500 years ago, he was wearing trousers. And that sounds funny now, and it's very easy to misunderstand, but nobody in Greece wore trousers. They wore tunics, but he wore trousers. And when he spoke to people, and people came to see him, they couldn't actually see him because he would speak to them from behind a curtain, just as the Persian kings used to do. And he imposed on people who wanted to learn from his school an initial, absolute, unbreakable, totally strict 5 years silence. That was the beginning. And it was made very, very clear in the Pythagorean tradition, you have to learn to be able to carry, to hold, to keep something real, silently in your breast, silently in your heart. And Empedocles says this too. There's a beautiful, just one line, where he tells the person reading his poem, cover over my words in your dumb breast. The word he uses for dumb is a very rare word in Greek, actually. It's a word that's always used for fish. I just try to mention this detail to make it a little bit more real. I mean, I remember years and years ago being in a relationship with somebody and being so close to her and wanting to communicate with her and actually having the experience of her being in the water and me being a fish underneath her. And a fish has a lot of trouble in speaking. To know that dumbness of a fish in the water is really quite something. Maybe that's something some of you can understand, whether it's from a relationship or something, this incredible and absolute dumbness. Not only where you're not allowed to speak, but where you can't speak. The organ is missing. But there's something else here about this silence. And it's so clear in Empedocles. I'm going to read to you now a few lines from just before what I read to you about the words being alive, where he says, if you don't listen to me, if you don't pay attention, you reach out instead after other things, the 10,000 worthless other things, then my words will gladly leave you. Just before that, he says something else. And this is so important. This is just, to me, it's not just important for you or me, whoever you are, but it's also important for what has happened to this whole civilization. And the clue is in silence. See, this is what he says. And he's been saying, you know, roof over my words, cover them over in your dumb breast. And then he says this. If you press my words down underneath your dense packed diaphragm and oversee them with goodwill and with pure attention to this work, they will all, without the slightest exception, stay with you for as long as you live, and from them you will come to possess many other things. For they grow, each according to its own inner disposition, in whatever way their nature dictates. See, they grow. The words grow. Something happens. This is a practice. And please, just look at it. I find this so unbelievably fascinating, just these lines of Empedocles, because what he's actually saying is he's presenting a practice for listening, a practice for speaking, and a practice for listening. You know, usually we go and listen to somebody, and we listen, and we probably don't make notes, or we make notes, or we remember something, and it touches us, or somebody says something really important to us, just a sentence, and it's there with us. But Empedocles is saying there's something to be done next. You have to plant those words. And there is a whole system, a whole intricate system of techniques for working with the words that are spoken. And this is just a part of it. Listening is just the beginning. Then the real agricultural work begins. The real inner farming. And that has all been completely lost. We listen, we go away, we remember or we don't remember. What we don't remember is that there's a whole art, a practice, a science to listening. That is stage one. There is stage two and three and four and five and six and seven. The point I want to make here is, do you see how important, how beautiful it is that there is this dynamic now where the words are received into silence? This is the original tradition in the West. This is the tradition of the great masters who actually created our Western civilization very, very consciously 2,500 years ago. They said, there are words, then they are planted, they are pushed down in silence into our being. And when they are attended to in the silence, they will pop up, they will grow. They are alive, they are organic. The silence is a part of an agricultural cycle. It's not the whole thing. The silence is creative. The silence is incredibly dynamic. The real silence is alive. The words are alive. The whole process is alive. And somehow I think we've ended up 2,500 years into this civilization, we think that silence is sitting like puddings or sausages. And then, of course, we feel repressed. We don't even think about it. I'm really looking forward to going to lunch, having a break, or just going and having a pee, anything. Because we don't understand anymore. We're not able to participate in the natural agricultural growth cycle of words, silence, and something coming out of the silence, which is totally new. We are stuck. Maybe individually we're stuck. I'm very interested in this about mystical silence, because before coming out, I actually did a little survey, kind of a spiritual survey. I asked people, it's just people I happen to be talking to in different traditions, Sufi, Buddhist, or whatever. What value does silence have for you? What does silence mean to you? What do you think is the purpose of silence? And it was interesting. Everybody said, well, it feels good. Helps me to meditate. Has a good energy. It relaxes me. It was all about me, me, me. Come on to that in a moment. But it's always, we don't really understand at all what silence is anymore, just as we don't understand what words are anymore. And somewhere we are stuck. We don't see this agricultural process. We sit with this dead weight of silence when we listen. We don't know how to take in the words. And this is how this culture has gone. Yada, 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 yada. And then we sit in meditation and we try and make ourselves be silent and we try and have good spiritual experiences. And there is no organic connection between the two. The silence has not borne fruit because we haven't been conscious of what the silence is. Nothing has come out of it. And I just like to say quickly, there's this, it reminds me of there is a beautiful series of inscriptions on the incubation temple in Epidaros in Greece. And this is a list of inscriptions inscribed in the marble, describing some of the miracles that happened when people came to this incubation center and lay down to have dreams, to be healed by Apollo or Apollo's son Asclepius. And I think it's either the second or the third of these stories, but they're not stories, they're actually accounts. They were written down by the priest after a person told them what happened when they left. And this is the way that the story goes. A woman comes from another part of Greece, and she comes to the temple because she wants to become pregnant. She really wanted to have a girl, a daughter. And she comes and she lies down in the temple. She'd been trying to get pregnant. No luck. This is what people usually do. It still happens. I've seen it on the Turkish-Syrian border where people will come to incubation shrines and lie down, women will, when they want to become pregnant. And this woman, 2,000 years ago, she comes, she lies down in the temple of Asclepius, and she wants a dream so that she can become pregnant. And when she's asleep, Asclepius comes to her in a dream, and he says, "What do you want, my dear?" And she says, "I've come because I really want a daughter." And he says, "Okay, that's no trouble. We'll arrange it." And then he says, "Is there anything else I can do to you?" And she said, "No, I just want to become pregnant. That's all. That will be enough." And so she goes away when she wakes up, and she becomes pregnant. But 3 years later, she's still pregnant. And so it says, after 3 years, she came back, and she lay down again. And she went to sleep again, And Asclepius came to her again in her sleep. And he said, "Oh, my dear, nice to see you again. What's your problem? What can I do for you?" And she said, "Well, I've been pregnant for a long time. I can't give birth." And he said, "Well, why didn't you tell me the first time you wanted to give birth?" You know, again, it's to do with the precision in words, you see. He said, "You know, you told me that you wanted to be pregnant, and that was all. You didn't tell me you wanted to give birth. You have to tell me and be specific." He said, "Of course, that's no problem." But he couldn't do it without having her specific request. And so it describes how she woke up, went out of the temple, and as soon as she left the temple door, boom, suddenly she gave birth out there in the courtyard. And it's like we have been pregnant for 2,500 years and we have not yet given birth. We're stuck. This pregnancy has become a stone in our bellies. Do you feel the weight of this silence? Do you feel the pregnancy, but it's heavy, it's not flowing? I know you want to go and have a pee or whatever. I know I'm talking too long. I don't care. This is my one and only chance. No. I don't know when I have another chance to talk. I don't know. I don't know anything. But it's not just me. It's not just this. Do you feel the heaviness in the room? Okay. Now, I want to finish by telling you something about silence. And this is from, it's actually from a very great Gnostic called Valentinus, who came within a hair's breadth. It was about 150 AD. He came within a hair's breadth of becoming Archbishop of Rome. But he wasn't allowed to. Just wasn't allowed to. And many, many people have commented, "My God, if this man had become Archbishop, the Christian world would be a very, very different entity now." Just so close. And he said, Valentinus said, "God is not one, God is two." I can't go into this now, but this is very, very important. And I understood the wisdom of this actually when I was flying out to Atlanta in the early in the year. It suddenly hit me. I'd just been in San Francisco Airport. I was waiting for my flight. And this was with United Airlines too. Funny how they're there all the time. And I had a little booklet written by a friend of Henri Corbin. And in fact, Henri Corbin's wife had given it to me. And I just opened it to the first page, and it was about Valentinus. And it said, "Valentinus said, God is not one, God is two." And then the writer goes on to say, "But for the sake of simplicity in order to conform with Orthodox Christianity, the followers of Valentinus compromised and made God one." Now that will sound crazy to us, but you know, I read that sentence and it was like a jolt of lightning went through my body back in March. And I looked up, and there was a United Airlines employee just coming down past me there. And I looked at her and I saw she was God. And I looked around at everybody and everybody was God. And there was a young guy with a rucksack just came and stood in front of me, took off his rucksack. He looked very unhappy, extremely confused, very tired. and I was seeing. I was actually seeing, good Lord, if I want to know the state of God right now, you know, we talk about the evolution of God and all this. If I want to know the state where God is at right now, I see it in this young man. He is tired and confused. And then I looked and there was someone smiling, and that was God smiling. God was everywhere. And God was one. But God had only become one through me accepting that God is two. That's how the Gnostics worked. That's why they got into trouble with the Christians. Because the Christians began by saying, God is one, one, one. And then what do you do with the devil? All the metis, all the cunning, all the trickery, all the naughtiness, all the darkness is abolished. And then we have the duality coming up through the back door. The Gnostics were much cleverer. They started by saying God is two. And then when you actually see it, God is in front of you. God is in everybody. God is in everything. And through the two-ness comes the oneness, not the other way around. And Valentinus said at the very beginning, he didn't just say God was two, but he said there were actually 30 couples. The first two, then the second, then the others. And out of these couples comes the whole of creation. He's very, very specific. He said these 30 first powers correspond to the 30 first years of Jesus' life. That's why he was only able to start teaching when he was 31. Because the whole thing had to come down and become manifested and incorporated in Jesus so that he could then go and do his teaching. But the first couple is this, the mother and the father. Silence is the mother of everything emitted by the deep. The deep is he, silence is she. Please listen to this. And this is another passage from his teaching. There is a perfect, this is already going through his successors, so it's not kind of quite there, but it's good enough. There is a perfect, pre-existent, eternal power that dwells in the realm that can never be seen or named. This is the pre-beginning, the forefather, the deep, who rests in quiet and deepest solitude for infinite eternities. And with him is his partner, silence. Once, the deep had the idea of emitting out of himself a beginning of everything like a seed, and he deposited this emission, as if into a womb, inside the silence who is with him. Silence received this seed and became pregnant, and she gave birth to consciousness. And she gave birth to civilizations and everything else. See, it's the same as in Empedocles. Silence is the womb in which the seeds are deposited, in which something grows. But that's not the point. That's not the main point. Silence is alive. Silence is a being in her own right, just as words are alive. When there is silence in a room and there is a certain presence there, that is the presence of her. You feel something coming into the room now. She is alive. This silence here is not just a dumb, repressed silence. It is the quality of the absolute feminine. and we have silenced her. Even with our mystical silence, even with our pious silences, we haven't understood, we've forgotten what silence really is. Everything is alive, but silence is the highest form of the feminine, the feminine aspect of the absolute. And she is everywhere, but she has to be acknowledged. She has to be heard. That's why sometimes, if it's right, and especially if someone speaks rightly, sometimes it's as if the walls in a room are vibrating. Silence is alive. Then there's an expectancy in the silence. There's an awakeness in the silence. And I know I can intuit somehow, because just as in that story of the woman going to the shrine of Asclepius and being stuck in a pregnancy, somewhere we need to give birth. And something new can come into being. And I have no idea what it is. But something can be born out of this silence. It's interesting timing. You just came right at the end of the talk.